Welcome to the Leadership Journey Podcast. I'm Alan Wilson, the host of the podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to various Christian leaders, discussing some of the things that have contributed to the story of their leadership, and at the same time, encouraging you as you listen to reflect on your own leadership journey. If you've not already subscribed to the podcast, you can do so for free on iTunes or on Castbox. Look for the Leadership Journey Podcast. And while you're there, it would be helpful if you're able to take a moment to write a comment or leave us a review. This week, Lucas Parks, pastor of Village Church in Belfast, is back on the podcast. We begin our conversation this week by asking how you might go about planting a church. And among other things in our conversation, Lucas talks about the work of the Acts 29 Church Planting Network. And he also talks very personally and very powerfully about his recent illness and the tough season of treatment. He shares some of the things that he has learned through the experience. Enjoy the podcast. Lucas, welcome back. I said to you at the end of the first part of our conversation that I was going to begin by asking you, well, how exactly do you plant a church?
Yeah.
So you started with conversations. Yeah. You know, previous time you talked about conversations you're having with young, disaffected, creative guys and women around Belfast.
Yeah.
And out of that, this desire to start a church. And here we are.
Sure.
And it's a Thursday afternoon. There's no church gathering in the building as such, but this is where well over 100 people gather regularly on a Sunday. So how do you get from where you were to where you are?
Yeah, well, I don't think there is a way. Certainly there's different people have done it in different ways. I can tell you how we did that. And part of that was the building, you know, spending a lot of time. A lot of church planters talk about year zero. So, you know, if they parachute into a place, you have year zero. So that's the year that you take in preparing before your public launch. Well, we had 2.5 years of year zero, you know, so...
So public launch, when you mean when you open your doors?
Yeah, open your doors.
Hey, there's a church here.
That's right. Okay. You know, so that was... Now, part of the story was in between Ridge Hill and where we are now, I went on staff at Glen Abbey and was there for, I would guess, probably 2 years because we felt called to plant in Belfast. But we knew we weren't ready for that yet, wanted to spend at least a year to try to figure things out and get to know, you know, lay of the land. Happened to meet those guys at a church planting conference. Long story short, good fit. They were wanting to be a resourcing church but didn't have a church planter. I'm a church planter without resources. And convictionally, I think churches should plant churches whenever possible. And so there you go. I go on staff at Glen Abbey. And during that time, living in Belfast, continuing to build these relationships, eventually they released me 2 days a week and then eventually 3 days a week and then, you know, eventually send me out to plant. And so all during that time, really just spending time with people, lots of people in our house, you know, Bible studies in our living room, and really just... and then this is going to sound maybe a bit cliche, but really just trying to plant the gospel first and allowing that to do its job, as it were, and the Holy Spirit to develop and mature and...
Do you mean more than
grow people?
Evangelize?
Yeah.
Tease that out for us.
Well, so some of the people we were meeting weren't Christians and needed to be converted. Some of them were Christians but hadn't been in church since they were maybe 15, you know, and had kind of walked away from that. Mm-hmm. And so there was some embers that needed to be, you know, rekindled there and you know, essentially discipling them into, you know, thriving Christians. And then you're also trying to notice, well, who are the leaders in this group and do leadership development during that time without them knowing that that's what you're actually doing, because they're too cynical at this point and might freak out. So, you know, you're trying to do some of this kind of
along with this goal of planting.
And it's not like I kept that secret, it wasn't a bait and switch, but
sure,
you know, they just needed time because their main issue was the church. And so anything that, you know, felt a little too formal or a little too, you know, official or anything like that, you know, just start getting a little bit sketchy with. And so you just had to disciple them into maturity enough to actually realize that the church is a good thing. Jesus gave his blood for it, that Jesus loves the church. And so, and them understanding why the church does certain things and You know, so all those things take a little bit of time. Mm-hmm. And then you, you know, end up with this kind of core of 20 adults or so.
So that was the, that's where you developed a core of people who would eventually become core of village.
Yeah, the core of village. And, you know, and some of those people are you know, now part of our eldership and, you know, our deacons and things like that. So, yeah, so that took some time. But that was just real relational and building trust and letting them ask a lot of questions and express their doubts and push back on stuff and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So, yeah.
And your fit. So during that time, your work, you, the focus of your work is changing. So yeah. You're doing,
I'm on staff at Glen Abbey still.
What were you doing on staff?
Yeah. So I oversaw the equipping ministry for adults. They would do kind of midweek, you know, classes. So I oversaw that, line managed their two youth workers. And then I was on the teaching team as well.
Okay.
So,
So, You develop this core. How do you make a decision when it's time to start?
Yeah, well, I think it was just once they were ready, essentially. So I wasn't under any kind of pressure. That was the nice thing about having Glen Abbey give us a long lead, as it were, and not put us under financial pressure. I think that's one of the downfalls is church planters feel this pressure, financially, and feel like they have to go faster than maybe they should to get to a place where they can sustain things financially. We didn't have that kind of pressure, which was amazing. And maybe we went slower than we should. I don't know, but it seemed to work okay. So give those people a chance to get their head around some of these things and get to a place where we weren't just going to sing for the sake of it. I wanted it to be a real response of their heart, an actual, because they desired to worship the Lord, not because, well, churches are supposed to sing, so we'll do that. Mm-hmm. So it was a year and a half before we ever sung together.
So you were gathering but not singing?
Yeah, it was basically, you know, group discipleship, essentially. I was, you know, teaching the Bible, letting them ask questions, you know, lots of discussion, lots of one-on-ones, and, you know,
There's a school of thought, and I'm sure you've come across it and had to answer this question before. There is a school of thought that would say something like, goodness me, there are so many churches in Belfast.
Yeah.
Why on earth another church in Belfast?
Yeah.
So I'm just going to let you answer.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a good question. And yeah, I mean, if you were to get out a map and say, let's map out the neediest places in Ireland, Belfast, you know, wouldn't make your top
probably
10.
Not East Belfast.
Certainly not East Belfast. But, you know, if you look at, I think a closer look, a lot of our churches are in decline. A lot of them are dying. I mean, we're sitting in a church building that closed. And same with our South congregation. It's in now what was a church building before. So the situation as a whole isn't great. You know, we're basically following the same trends as the rest of Europe. And so, man, if you could have swelled, you know, if you could have quelled some of that earlier, you know, maybe this is our opportunity to do that as well.
Do you think church planting then is a can be a strategy for revitalizing the church?
It's one piece. It's not the only. Sure. So church planting, church revitalization, revival, all those things. And some of that is, I think, part of the what church planting and church planters bring to the table is helping the church, I think, see a need for revitalization. Mm-hmm. They can actually see, okay, this could work if we did this or that. You know, it becomes a place where experiments prove right or wrong, for better or worse. It's also, I think, places where the church can see how they can revitalize without having to shut down first within that. And sometimes churches have to, I guess, reorganize. Keller talks about in Center Church, you know, churches in cities might have people leaving other churches and going to new church plants. And so it looks like church growth, but there's not a net growth overall. Mm-hmm. And I think you're going to inevitably have some of that in a place like Belfast, where churches are closing, where they're getting older. The church is going to reorganize to some degree. I don't think that should be our strategy for church planting. I think evangelism and seeing lost people come to Christ or unchurched or de-churched people re-engage should be our main strategy for mission. But along the way, you're also going to get other people coming along as well.
For different, who will leave other churches. Yeah.
And thankfully, for different reasons. The vast majority of Christians who have come to us are not leaving local churches in Belfast to come to us. Mm-hmm. They're moving back from Scotland or England. Yeah. They're getting married, or they're moving to Belfast for the first time, or yeah. you know, things like that. So mm-hmm. we've had very few people leave, you know, other churches in East Belfast to come to us.
Do you have any policy towards people who, you know, let's say who turn up here some Sunday?
Yeah.
They've fallen out with the church, you know,
yeah.
a few hundred yards up the road.
Sure. There.
Yeah. Do you have a policy on how you deal with them?
Yeah, I don't know if we have a policy. I mean, we have a pretty robust membership structure, how you become a member here. And so that would all get fleshed out during membership, you know, if they actually wanted to join here, mm-hmm. For sure. And we do things pretty relational. It's pretty hard to just to come and attend here. Mm-hmm. The way we structure missional communities and things like that, you know, your story is going to get known fairly well to be a meaningful part of our church.
Okay, tell us, missional community. It's a term which
I know
village folk use that one a lot.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about, should we call them that, or should we, you know?
So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so they are basically, you know, I think most people probably be familiar with home group or small group.
Yeah.
So it's essentially that plus mission. So, you know, to use the simplest terms I know how. So, mm-hmm. So you know, our missional communities kind of have three ingredients of what we call family dinner. So most MCs will meet on the same night each week for family dinner.
Literally
come and have dinner together.
Yeah.
So a lot of, you know, we take turns making dinner. People bring different elements, whatever that is. But eating is a big part of, and we have theological reasons why we think that's important. And they'll do some Bible study of some sort, pray together, minister to each other in that way. Sometimes it's we provide kind of further deep dive from Sunday after that. We also have core groups within that then. So those are smaller, you know, same sex, you know, no more than three or four kind of, you know, discipling groups. And then that each of those missional communities is really meant to be on mission together as well. And so, how will they reach the people that they have circle of influence with? And so that looks different for each one. We don't prescribe that top down, but try to encourage them to be able to do that.
Okay. And do you have a large percentage of people who come here on a Sunday be part then of a mission?
Yeah. I don't know what the percentage is, but I would have to guess that would have to be north of 85%.
That's remarkable. I think most churches would probably be happy if it was 50%.
Yeah, I think because that's how we started our church. So we had MCs before we had a Sunday gathering.
Right.
So that's just been the DNA of our church from the very beginning.
So how did you come to the point then of being able to plant another church in East?
Like I said, we that area of South Belfast was still very much, on our heart. A venue became available, and we still had a large, good chunk of our folks living there. We have MCs in that area because that's where we started. I used to live there. I moved over here once we kind of acquired this building. But we also had a church planter that we had been developing and did a church planting residency through Acts 29 and Crosslands, which is Crosslands is essentially a theological training seminary that allows people to stay in their context that was developed between Oak Hill and Acts 29.
Okay, so you just mentioned Acts 29. I think it's the first time we've formally mentioned that. So, you're fine. You get in trouble with your bosses.
Yeah.
I need to put this in the production then. But Acts 29,
church planting network
of churches. Church plants that plant churches.
That's right. Yeah, global network. I think we're closing in on 750, 800 churches globally. So
amazing. Yeah. How many of that's outside of the US?
I think we're almost 50-50 now. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so well over 350 churches.
Outside the US.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that's right.
Yeah. Okay, but back to East then?
Yeah. Sorry, what was the question?
I've forgotten as well. So. we were talking about
how do we plant another church? So we had shifted from south to east, and obviously acquired this building. Had really filled this building. We were putting out extra chairs and having the question of, do we go to two services? And then all while our philosophy has always been it's better to plant churches than to try to grow one as big as we can. And so we're always wanting to be developing that next planter. And we don't have, you know, a secret map somewhere with you know, locations on it. But as the Lord leads us and as opportunities develop, we'd love to continue to see other churches being planted. Mm-hmm. And some of those might be kind of a part of the village family officially, and some may not be, and you know, that's okay. So we'll see how those go.
When did it start then, Village East?
South?
South.
October of last year.
I've added another element of
confusion. No, that's okay. Village South.
No wonder you can't answer the question.
We planted
the right words.
Yeah. No, we planted South in October.
October.
Yeah, last year.
Okay.
Yeah.
How important has been in the whole growth of this, and you know, sending out others to plant this new congregation, how important has it been for you as a leader to really develop your team?
Important, yeah. I think especially if you're going to send people out to where, you know, they're not under your direct, you know, supervision, to use a lack of a better term, on a Sunday.
Yeah.
You know, you're sending them out to be a pastor, for them to develop their own team, as it were, as well, and to, you know, to equip them to be able to do that. Whilst us staying as a family of churches, you're able to do that quicker because you're not just sending them out on their own completely.
Yeah.
They're still connected to, you know, all of us together, one kind of leadership team overseeing all of that. And, you know, they're not having to develop everything from scratch. You know, you have to reinvent the wheel every time. So there's lots of advantages to that. So it becomes critical to be able to develop that team and to trust each other.
Come back here to this local Village East. What do you do to continue to build into the team that you've got around you, with you?
Yeah. We meet together every single week. We office together. You know, so we have regular staff meetings. The thing that I mentioned before, I think a lot of that is spending time relationally together, which as you get bigger becomes harder to do, but I think becomes more important to do.
As you get busier as well.
Because that's really where I think that relational capital is really where your foundation of trust is. It's where we give each other the benefit of the doubt when, you know, we're misunderstood or when somebody says, because communication becomes a lot more complex. The more layers of leadership, the more layers of you've added a second church, a second congregation, you know, you keep multiplying all of these things. Everything becomes more complex. Mm-hmm. So communicating becomes more complex. Scheduling becomes more complex. All of these different things. So developing our time together relationally is really how those things stay together. And maybe there's more efficient ways to do that. I'm just maybe not that good of a leader. and that's, I think, you know, your strengths are sometimes your biggest weakness as well. So I'm more of an intuitive leader.
Yeah.
But that's also a great weakness because it's hard to then teach someone how to.
Well, exactly, because there are lots of things that you do as a leader that are simply instinctive.
Yeah.
And if someone says, "Well, so how would you recommend we go about this?" Oh, yeah. I don't really know.
And that probably is a lot of how I do things, mm-hmm. Which can frustrate people who are, you know, very much, I want to see every single point between here and 10. And I'm like, I only have the first three, mm-hmm. and we'll figure out the other seven as we go, you know, sort of a thing. So,
right.
So I think that's where that trust and relationship and developing your team in those areas mm-hmm. become very, very important. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Looking along your leadership journey, what have been some of the big defining moments that have kind of either shaped you as a person or given you convictions about mm-hmm. how to lead or what church should be?
Very good. I mentioned us moving to Detroit and being a part of a church there for 5 years, and that ended very, very badly. Not with us and the church, the church within itself. So that church essentially fractured into three different churches. Oh. So the leadership team just kind of completely fell apart, and there was a lot of seeds of mistrust and things like that sown within that. And that, it just became really ugly and nasty. And people who had been friends, lifelong friends, who were in their 40s, you know, stopped talking to each other and, you know, chose sides and all sorts of different things. So I think that was a very definitive moment. I think I've learned most of those lessons looking back. Because I think in the moment, it's hard to learn some of those lessons when there's so much emotional baggage attached to that. You have to have some distance and to be able to look back at that. So how elders worked, and again, even some of the things that we've probably been talking about have probably come out of that. Mm-hmm. The need for trust and that relational strength, mm-hmm. And watching that kind of disintegrate and fall apart over time, mm-hmm. and in Detroit.
Sort of gives you determination to be on extra guard, really.
I think, certainly against unity at a leadership level, And not unity at all costs, but certainly unity... to be vigilant and to guard that and to know that that's not something that is assumed within that.
Yeah, certainly one of the things that I probably feel more and more is that the unity of a leadership team is really paramount.
Yeah.
You know, as you say, it can't be unity at any cost.
Sure, yeah.
But, I think sometimes things happen in churches or even in organizations. And maybe the way I would put it is that the issue is not really the issue. It becomes a bit of a sideshow, and the real issue is how the team deals with it. Because sometimes issues come and go, but they leave damage because of the way they've been dealt with. And I think leadership teams need to be very, very vigilant.
I couldn't agree more. Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. So, and I mean, we just had an elders 24-hour away together, working retreat essentially, and it's one of the things we talked about that unity just can't be assumed. We just did a series on the Psalms of Ascent, so Psalm 133, how good it is for brothers to dwell in unity, and that's something I think that the Spirit gives us, but also that we have to work really hard for. And part of that is just being godly men and women, that we actually have that character to be able to sustain us through crises or when... you have personalities that might disagree on how we should move forward. How do you get past that? What could be an impasse? And even the Apostle Paul couldn't work that out at times. Right. So it's hard and it's difficult. But I think you have to just be... My wife and I determined early on in our relationship that divorce was just never going to be an option for us. We just took that off the table. And I think at some level, the churches need to be able to do that too. We're just going to take certain things off the table, and that's just not going to be an option for us. So we're just going to work through this without us, splittering into three different churches because we're all just going to go our separate ways, sort of a thing. So how will we be able to work through worst case scenarios? Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. yeah. But you have to do that when everything... It's hard to do that when the weather is nice, to prepare for the storm. But I think that's what we have to be able to do.
Okay. Now, obviously, in terms of defining moments, I guess the past 6 months.
Yeah. Well, that was Detroit was obviously one of them. I think. I think. So I'll be 45 this summer. I think years 40 to 42 were kind of defining for me. Working through some. I think just mental health stuff and, midlife.
And you said Village started 5 years ago.
Yeah, publicly. So it was right around that time. Right. Okay. I don't know if... remember having a conversation or two with Marcus Honeysett. Marcus. And just trying to work through some of these things with him and trying to figure out what was going on. And I think coming to the realization that there was probably about five different things going on at the same time. So... realizing I had seasonal affective disorder, which, when you live in Ireland, it can be a real...
Growing up in Ireland.
Yeah. Living all in Ireland. Yeah, so, but that's a real thing. Like, I just had to figure that out. Turning 40, your body definitely changes, and you do have to, I think, you know, they don't call it a midlife crisis for nothing.
40's young.
No, it is. It is. It certainly is.
Somebody who's had another, has had a landmark moment.
Yeah. No, it is. But there's a difference between being 40 and 20 for sure. Yeah. And you start to ask yourself questions that you haven't had to face before. Yeah. And so trying to work through some of those things. And then I hadn't really taken a break from ministry in the 20 some years I've been doing it for probably more than 2 weeks. And so I went on a 3 month sabbatical and, yeah, I just tried to be healthier, in a lot of ways. So that was a defining moment. And then, you know, cancer has been.
Sure. Can I pause on that one a little bit? Yeah. You know, for the 40 to 42 thing.
Yeah.
You know, that sense of, I guess, needing to work through some things. Emotional health, physical health.
Yeah.
What sort of counsel would you give to people who are maybe in the same sort of age bracket?
Yeah.
Because at 40 or even 45, I mean, God willing, you still have, you know, quite a bit of time.
I hope so, yeah.
Of active ministry ahead. But that needs to be sustained, doesn't it?
It is. It's trying to work out ministry that is sustainable. And there's a balance there. You know, I saw somebody tweet out, because the whole idea of Sabbath, I think, has been an idea that has come back around. A lot of people are talking about it again, and rightly so. But I saw somebody tweet out all these 30-year-olds talking about Sabbath when they haven't learned to work 6 days a week yet. And I thought, there might be a little truth in that as well. And so,
not in your
mine, but how do we do ministry in a way that is sustainable and yet where we work hard? We know how to work, but we also know how to stop working. And we know how to Sabbath well. We know how to rest well. And that has to really be guarded against as well. Because in ministry, it's not a 9-to-5 job. And things are important. And it's hard to say no to people. And it's hard to plan. You know, there are things that come up and emergencies happen. But how do we try to schedule and to develop ways in doing ministry that are sustainable for the long haul. And I'm probably just now starting to work that out. Cancer again, and realizing our bodies are fragile, and has made me have to stop and reevaluate some things again. So,
I come to the cancer.
Otherwise, we burn out.
But I noticed also you mentioned you'd spoken to Marcus Honeysett from Living Leadership.
Yeah. So yeah, I did. Yeah.
So, but
yeah.
That whole idea, even of reaching out to someone outside of your situation, and saying, "Can I talk to you about some of this?" Yeah. You recommend that?
I think
or somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you have to have people that you can go to outside of your situation. I think you also have to be able to be honest with the people inside your situation. Yeah. And so, you know, my elders are a little bit younger than me, and so some of this is guiding them through that, and so just being open and honest with them as well. I don't think it's healthy just to go all outside. I think you have to be able to do both of those things. But to get outside help, and saw a counselor for a little while, and some of those things can be kind of stigmas, but I think those things just have to be broken down and talked about honestly. So I just saw like the 10 most stressful jobs or jobs that end in suicide, whatever, you know, these lists come out, and I think being a pastor was number 5 on that. So and some of that is our own doing, and some of it is the nature of the job where we feel like I can't talk to anybody, or you know, if I admit some of these things, is my actual job at stake here? Is my livelihood at stake? And and I think we as ministers just have to be able to work through those things and be honest about that, have people we can actually talk to, both in and outside the church that we trust.
Yeah.
And that goes back to, you know, what I was saying before, we can become so siloed off at times that we can put ourselves in real dangerous positions.
Yeah, and if we're siloed off, particularly within our own denomination, where there can be a little bit of competitiveness, and the a desire to show that you're measuring up to your colleagues. Too much of that, and then you can't demonstrate weakness because it's word gets around the denomination that
that's right,
you're not really making it, you're not pulling your weight or whatever it might be.
Yeah. And it's our sinful nature. None of us want to admit our weakness in that.
And
you know, but it is, I mean, Paul is right. You know, it is in our weakness that often, you know, we do our best ministry.
Yeah.
And so being able to operate out of your weaknesses, I think, is really important as well.
Yeah.
Because it is. It allows God to actually do the work for you in ways that when I'm, you know, when I feel like I'm at my best, I'm just not as reliant on Him. And that's just human nature, I guess. But, you know, I'm trying to learn those lessons. And, you know, even on my good days or those seasons where you feel like, oh, I'm just knocking it out of the park, it's because of my reliance on the Holy Spirit and not on my own, you know, schemes.
Yeah. Well, you've obviously, with this illness that you've come through, you've obviously been forced in a very dramatic way to face up to your own vulnerability.
Yeah.
I remember getting a text from you. I think it was maybe in August. I was away for the weekend with family, and you texted me to tell me about this diagnosis that had happened. Talk to us a little bit about that and what that's been like and what you've been learning through it.
Yeah, well, I think I'm still processing some of it,
For
sure. But yeah, I think, you know, I watched my dad die of cancer 3 years ago, it'll be 3 years ago next month. And he was nearly 70 when he died. So I wasn't expecting that quite as early on, obviously, in my life. And so it did kind of take us by surprise within that and having to kind of face your own mortality. Thankfully, the kind of cancer I had is really responsive to treatment. But at the end of the day, the Lord is sovereign, and stats don't really, you know, in my mind, matter too much. So, it essentially taught me a few things. I mean, off the top of my head,
let's just talk for a moment.
About
the actual experience of.
Oh yeah, sorry.
Diagnosed.
Yeah, sorry. So, at first, I thought it was just going to be pretty straightforward.
Some grueling treatment.
Yeah, at first, you know, the doctor said, "Listen, I could see the tumor in my mouth, and that's a good thing and a bad thing. Good thing, I thought that's all it was, and so." You know, when the doctor said, "Listen, I'm pretty sure this is cancer. I'm going to schedule you for surgery here in the next couple of weeks, and we'll, you know, to cut that out." And I said, "Okay, well, how long will it take to recover from that surgery?" And he said, "Probably a couple of weeks." And so in my mind, I thought, "Okay, I have a little bit of cancer, but like skin cancer, they'll just cut it out, and I'll be fine within the month." Well, turns out that's not the case, and essentially they were doing a biopsy. And after the surgery, then, you know, kind of said, "Listen, you know, you have some in your neck, and it's more than what I thought it was. This is going to be 7 weeks of radiation, Monday to Friday, every day, with chemo every week alongside of that." So we have a nurse that works in the cancer ward and basically said, "You got the hardest treatment that we offer." And so it wasn't the cancer that was the hard part.
She told you that afterwards?
Yeah. And it was the treatment that's the hard part. It's them getting rid of the cancer that's the hard part. So couldn't eat. You know, I lost 5.5 stone. Some of that I needed to lose. That was maybe a blessing in disguise. But was hospitalized, you know, for 3 weeks of that. Essentially was out of work for 5-6 months. During that time, you know, your wife sees you at your most vulnerable state, you know, thinks she's watching you die on the bathroom floor. And, you kind of get to the end of yourself pretty quickly. You just realize that you don't have any real resources in and of yourself. So, you know, we throw around these kind of cliched phrases as pastors a lot, that we depend on God for everything. And that is true. And, you know, I certainly believed that before I had cancer. But you just know and experience that in a completely different way when you actually have to go through that, to barely be able to pull yourself off the floor to get into your bed and, to kind of watch your physical self and strength. You know, I've always been a strong guy, and you have to rely on your wife, to lift, things up into a cupboard because you don't even have the physical strength to do that, and to have to, you know, allow work stuff for other people to have to do your job instead of you. And so, yeah, it's not, you know, and then physically, you know, you're sick, you're, you know, there's a lot of, you know, throwing up during that time, and feeding tubes and all sorts of, you know, stuff, radiation every day, and chemo, you know, during that time. So, yeah, it's the hardest thing I've ever gone through. You know, certainly the hardest thing I've ever gone through physically, mm-hmm. and probably emotionally too, you know. So, yeah, you have the full range of emotions, you know, during that time, you know, with your kids and your wife, and have to explain, you know, things to young kids, you know, that are old enough to watch and understand, but not old enough to understand all the ins and outs of that through that time. But it was, you know, this again sounds like something a pastor would say, but it really was a gift in so many ways. Like, there's just things that God did in our life and marriage and family and church and me personally over the last 6 to 8 months that, it, you know, in some ways I feel like a completely different person. Mm. I look like one in the mirror. I look in the mirror and I'm like, who's that guy? You know, I can't, you know, the radiation took my beard away, you know, I lost all this weight. And so I'm like, yeah, I literally don't recognize myself.
What would you say were some of the things that helped sustain you and to sustain your faith in God through it all?
Yeah. well, some of that is just the actual experience of the power of the presence and peace of Christ Himself. And so, this is where I'll start to sound less reformed and more charismatic, probably, but that's okay. Because I wish I could say I had all this time in the Word, but I literally couldn't read. I just couldn't focus enough to read anything really during that time. I'd start to read something, and, you know, a paragraph later, I couldn't remember what I read. Mm-hmm. I could listen to things, but I couldn't really read anything. And so it honestly was Jesus just meeting me and reassuring me of His presence and I guess His power in my life in ways that are hard to describe. So if you've read, Brother Lawrence wrote a book called The Practice of the Presence. So he's a, you know, a monk. And, in one of his letters, he says, you know, there are times that he has with the Lord that are so delicious that he's embarrassed to describe them. And I just remember reading that probably in my 30s going, what is he talking about? Like, I would never use the word delicious, and what do you mean he's embarrassed to talk about them? And yet now, yeah, I mean, I would say the same. I mean, there are times where I remember one time, you know, I have to drink so much water. I don't have saliva glands at work at the minute, so because of the treatment. So I'm up in the middle of the night a lot to go to the bathroom, and I remember coming back to bed and laying next to my wife who's asleep and, you know, just weeping. And it just felt like, and this is, again, embarrassing to say, or it almost sounds sacrilegious to say, like the Lord was in bed with me, like hugging me and, you know, like embracing me. And so those are real, like real moments that are hard to describe and in some ways sound, you know, ridiculous to actually say. Just those, you know, those times of prayer and listening, you know, to the Lord and Him just assuring me, you know, of His love, and His presence. And His care in just really personal ways. And some of that he does that through other people. You know, he does it primarily, you know, through my wife during that time. Who essentially would read, you know, kind of for me. You know, she would be the one, you know, quoting the Bible to me, you know, reminding me, you know, of certain passages, still does, you know, along the way. Just the intimacy that I think he brought in our marriage was so much him meeting both of us at the same time, at the same place. And so, you know, it's the Lord literally bringing you together. It didn't feel like cancer brought us together. It felt like cancer was the reason that the Lord was more present. And he brought us closer together. Same with my kids, especially my eldest daughter, who's 14. It was just phenomenal, you know, through that process as well, and matured through that. So, yeah, there's just moments that I think the Lord meets you that are just they're just hard to describe. But they reinforce all the things that he reveals, you know, to us, you know, that in our weakness, he'll provide strength, that is outside of us, that he will never leave us and forsake us, that he loves us, you know, and that's, but there are times in our suffering that I think he reveals those to us in ways that we just need during that time that are just different in other ways. And so I love my kids all the time, mm-hmm. but they experience my love mm-hmm. in different ways at different times. And certainly when they're hurting, they experience my love and care mm-hmm. in a different kind of way. And I don't think that's any different, you know, than our Heavenly Father who we experience his love in different ways and different times. And so certainly that was part of that mm-hmm. Experience.
Mm-hmm. Is there any particular lesson that you would like to talk about? Something that you've learned that you didn't have?
Yeah. Again, these are probably things that you know in your head that just become more real. So, I mean, the lesson is that I'm just not in control of anything. Yeah. Is the truth. As much as we as leaders like to think we are, we at the end of the day, we just aren't. You know, there was nothing that I could control during that situation at all. You know, I couldn't control anything that was going on in my body. You know, I essentially was out. I you know, not that I'm in control of anything now that I'm back, but, you know, I wasn't here at the church. You know, I was here, you know, when I could be on a Sunday, but that was it. And other people, you know, had to pick up the slack. But when Jesus says he's building this church, he actually means it, and he'll do it without you. And I mean, he does it through us, which is a great privilege and honor, but he doesn't need us in that sense. And so, yeah, it just is a real humbling experience to know I'm not really in control of anything, that the Lord really is in control of those things. And so it has caused me to relate to him in different ways, even in my prayer life. How I ask for things is probably, you know, I think a little bit different, at least in my mind and approach to that. Yeah, we all know that. We all say that, listen, the Lord is in control of everything. But when it is stripped out of your hands at every level, mm-hmm. You know, for months, you really learn that lesson in a new way. Mm-hmm. But that gives me a lot of confidence, too, you mm-hmm. know, because a lot of times as leaders, we think that these things really depend on us. And if I don't make it, or if I don't do this, then these things aren't going to happen, and that might be true in a, you know, one little circumstance or in that moment, but in the grand scheme of things, you know, the Lord could have not spared my life, and, you know, the kingdom is going to roll on, you know, anyway. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I think there was a humbling experience there that I'm not really in control of anything. Mm-hmm. But that the Lord probably loves me, loves us a lot more than I probably experienced up until that point as well. So, you know, there's been a couple periods in my life that I look back where, you know, we lost a child as well through a stillbirth, and that was very hard and difficult. And, you know, emotionally, And again, the Lord meets you in supernatural ways during those times. But, as much as I would never choose those things, I would never choose to go through cancer again or chosen it in the first place. The experience that you have with the Lord during those times is, there's no other way to go through them, I guess, is you just have to go through those times of pain, mm-hmm. And difficulty to experience the Lord in that way, because it's what you need at that time. That I think he meets those needs.
Well, these are crucibles from which gold is extracted.
Yeah. I think so. I hope so. Yeah. And, you know, my wife always says, listen, the Lord never wastes our pain. And that's, you know, one of her little phrases that she's, you know, almost mantra. And it's true. You know, he doesn't. And so, you know, I sense that the Lord, you know, you're trying to make sense of this, you know, kind of period of your life of going, okay, if that's true, what does he have for me in this next season of my life? You know, what are the next, if he spares my life, the next 20 years of ministry as opposed to the first 20 years, you know, so kind of feel like I'm at halftime, you know, at the minute and going, okay, well, how are you shaping me and to the person that you have, and what are you doing in my relationships and in my marriage and family life, now, you know? And so at some level, I'm excited by that because I feel like the Lord's doing real deep work. And I don't think he's doing that, you know, for no reason.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to see, you know, the reasons that he's doing that. Mm-hmm. And should he continue to give me opportunities, what those, you know, might look like and how it continue to, you know, develop me in that way. Yeah.
Lucas, thank you so much.
Yeah,
and thank you for sharing so personally. It's a privilege for me to hear you talk like that.
Thanks.
And I think for all who, you know, are listening to this, I think we'll sense that same sense of privilege that you have talked so personally about what has been a very deep experience for you.
Yeah.
And thank you for the time. I don't know if there's any final word that you want to you know, to bring just as we go off this episode, or do we just want to leave it there?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, leading from your weakness is a good thing.
Leading from your weakness. Yeah, there's a verse that struck me quite a number of years ago when I was going through a bit of a leadership crisis, and it's from 2 Corinthians, where Paul says, "This happened so that we would learn not to rely on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead."
Yeah.
And I think it's a very profound leadership lesson.
Yeah, I agree.
Lucas, thank you and God bless you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Lucas. And thank you to those of you who've been listening for taking time to listen to the podcast. The podcast will be back again next week, so be sure to join us. And in the meantime, have a good week.